Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Century Marine versus Badlucka.
May it please the court, I will demonstrate two things. The first is that the scope of review, the legal sufficiency challenge, depends necessarily on the type of no evidence argument being presented to the court. And the second is that in this case, if the proper scope of review for no evidence point had been applied, then the $700,000 testimonial admission of the plaintiff himself would have conclusively established, as a matter of law, the opposite of the vital fact that the plaintiff had to prove to win, and that was the condition precedent had been met.
Mr. Roach, would there be a third question? Is that how and when, if you did, preserve this argument that you're making to us today?
Your Honor, we made it at the post-verdict motion stage and at JMOB.
Would it be a fair statement that you relied basically on Griffin versus Superior as your case that establishes your theories?
It establishes our testimonial admission.
That's what I mean. That.
Yes. I want to make another argument to you in addition, but that is the testimonial admission case.
But so the whole argument hinges on whether that's a testimonial judicial admission.
I have a fallback position that is not briefed, Your Honor. And I have to tell you what that is.
A fallback position that's not briefed?
That is not briefed. It is a version of the same argument. I don't mean to upset the court, but let me
just say. No, I'm not upset. I'm just nonplussed on how we can talk about a non-briefed point.
It's not a non-briefed point.
Or non-briefed theory.
Well, it's an explanation of what we have here. Same thing that we briefed, Your Honor, and that is that when there is undisputed evidence, uncontroverted evidence, which is an admission under Griffin, that is something that the jury can't disregard. Now, what we've said is it's an admission is an admission is an admission, and any inference to the contrary is unreasonable. What I'm just advancing now, and it's not a change of our position at all or a new argument, it is the same, and it's a scope of review argument. It says that neither a jury nor a court of appeals can disregard what is an uncontroversial.
Is it really correct that you never said that and cited Griffin until you filed a petition of review with our court?
Didn't cite Griffin. That's correct, Your Honor.
And that the argument that you made on your motion for reconsideration in the Court of Appeals was based on the dissent.
Well, the dissent fought our argument, and we were happy to say
like
the
a light
right.
went on.
I'm sorry?
Like a light went on.
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. We argued absolutely positively.
Well, I've looked at what you don't talk about what you're talking about today in your motion for JNOV. You didn't talk about it in this manner in your JOVN in the motion for new trial. And you didn't talk about it in your brief to the Court of Appeals.
It has been our theory entirely throughout this case, Your Honor, that when the plaintiff admits to a loss that conclusively establishes.
Well, does it conclusively establish? I mean, you've got $700,000 in the red, but there's this, and there's that, and there's this. It gets into the figure that granted, not that the Court of Appeals relied on, but, I mean, him saying, acknowledging that at one point in time it was $700,000 in the red doesn't necessarily exclude the way he applied these other credits and came to the over $300,000 figure, does it?
There are really two questions, Your Honor. There is a question of whether they actually met the condition present at the time, and then another question, and that is whether they could have met it in the future but for the defendant's actions. That's the Kiewit issue. As to the first, whether they actually met the $300,000 condition precedent, is conclusive as to that. $700,000 loss, $200,000 profit means a loss of $500,000, period. You have this other issue, though, that the Court of Appeals very correctly, no challenge, says there are other charges that could be counted as evidence for this future issue. Okay, but for the defendant's breach of anticipatory breach or fraud, what would the condition precedent have been met?
But that's their legal theory. That they said they're excused from having to meet the condition preceding because of the conduct of the defendant, which prevented them from doing so.
That is exactly right.
So the evidence that Justice O'Neill has referred to is material to the legal issue that needed to be decided, the issues in the case.
That's right. But they really didn't attempt at trial to prove the second part. They didn't attempt to prove that in the future that they could have met the $300,000.
Okay. Let me go back. I'm a little bit confused with your – as I understand your theory, you're claiming that the plaintiff's testimony in this case was a judicial admission that established as a matter of law that he could not prevail on his contract claim.
That's right. Or fraud.
But at the same time, in your motion for rehearing from the denial and the petition for review, you acknowledge that if we don't accept your judicial admission argument, that in fact there is some evidence to support the jury's verdict.
If we don't win $700,000, where do we lose?
Because there is some evidence, which would mean that there's some evidence to support the jury's verdict.
It really just means that we haven't carried our burden for Calvert's fourth type of issue. What we're acknowledging is if we can't conclusively establish,
right, if you can't, and if because if you can't conclusively establish, then you're falling back to a no evidence standpoint from the standpoint of is there any evidence, and you admit there is some evidence.
There is evidence of some things. There is what we do not admit. There's evidence that the profit condition was met originally, and we don't admit that it would have been met. But if you accept the Court of Appeals analysis, we lose.
But you say here, for example, if this court disregards all the evidence and reasonable inferences contrary to the verdict, as respondent says it must, petitioners lose. And maybe I'm missing something, but that seems to tell me that under an is there any evidence standard, that there is some evidence.
We still don't think there are reasonable inferences, but if the court says, certainly the Court of Appeals thought that there were reasonable inferences supporting five different charges.
Well, and you admit that there are reasonable inferences in here, because it says,
yes,
if this court disregards all the evidence and reasonable inferences contrary to the verdict, as respondent says it must, petitioners lose.
That's right.
Well, then here's my problem with this then. I fail to see if there is some evidence in the record that supports the jury's verdict, then how there could conceivably be the type of judicial admission that Griffin talks about as being unequivocal to take it to the as a matter of law standard.
Yeah, I think it depends entirely, Your Honor, on your sequence of review. If you look first to see whether there are inferences that you can draw that support the verdict, and don't look at whether or not you have conclusively established the opposite of the vital fact, condition present was a matter, you can sustain.
Well,
but if you do the opposite, you can't, because it becomes unreasonable. They become unreasonable inferences if we have prevailed and established that the profit condition wasn't or could not have been met.
But if you're going to meet your burden as a matter of law standard, then you're going to have to show as a matter of law that there was no conflicting evidence, that in fact the evidence did establish an element or a point as a matter of law. Which,
yes,
which
yes,
under, which is my, in my understanding of reading all of the reading and being familiar with the as a matter of law cases, that means there's no conflicting evidence, no contrary evidence. I mean, I don't know of any cases that go differently than that. Do you?
I don't think there's any case that goes to the issue we're presenting here today.
No. My point is, if I go back and look at the jurisprudence, to the extent that an appellate court has applied an as a matter of law standard in reviewing an evidentiary record to determine that the evidence does establish something as a matter of law, that we find in those opinions the discussion that there is no conflicting evidence or contrary evidence.
Yes.
And in this by definition. But in this particular case, there is in fact some conflicting evidence, as you admit in here, that there are reasonable inferences that if you disregard all the evidence and reasonable inferences contrary to the verdict, then you lose. That must mean that there is some evidence that conflicts. And what you're asking us to do is to apply Griffin to the point that even in the face of conflicting evidence, that we should treat a statement by the plaintiff from the witness stand as being a judicial admission such that we should disregard any other contrary evidence in the record. I mean, that's what I understand you're asking us to do. And that seems to me to be going a whole lot further than we've ever gone.
May I explain, Your Honor?
Mm-hmm.
The conflicting evidence that you and I both agree is there does not get to the point of satisfying the condition present. Okay? We say the condition present isn't met. We will concede there is some conflicting evidence that will get you some of the way toward a $300,000 profit. But we do not concede that the $300,000 profit is established. All we said in the line that you quoted, Your Honor, is that if the Court of Appeals is if the Court of Appeals analysis is taken for what it is, and we don't get the 700,000 figure instead of the 408,000 figure because of the testimony admission, we're out of court.
But I don't understand how that can be conclusive when, in fact, the plaintiff's theory of the case is that it was the defendant's conduct that that prohibited the condition precedent from being met.
As a legal matter, Your Honor, there is no way that the only case on this issue is Keewood. Mm-hmm. And that case does not stand for the proposition that you get to completely excuse the failure of the condition precedent to be met. It stands for the opposite position, and that is you still have to prove that but for the defendant's actions that you would have met the condition precedent.
But the jury found that. The jury found that. So if we're going to do a sufficiency review in respect to that, why aren't we going to then consider all of that evidence and any reasonable inferences that flow from it to support the jury's verdict?
The jury did not find that because that was not the plaintiff's theory at trial. The plaintiff had a legally inadequate view, and that was all we have to do is show fraud, and that excuses us from trying to prove that the condition precedent was met. We're the first people to say, no, you didn't satisfy your verdict. You still have to prove that the condition precedent would have been met in the future but for the actions of the defendants. So the jury didn't agree. And the jury, getting back to the Griffin, the jury was not permitted, and the Beaumont Court of Appeals was not permitted to take uncontroverted testimony of admission evidence and ignore it. And if it wasn't ignored, we win. Plain as day.
Well, let me ask you this, based on your statement, there is other evidence in the record. Isn't there a line of cases that said that if something like this happens, that you have to protect your record by objecting to any other evidence that might controvert the $700,000 statement, and whether the record will show that you did this, or is this evidence in there without objection on that basis?
That's a question that I've looked at myself, Your Honor, and I looked at Griffin to see if there was anything about an objection having been raised there, and I didn't see any objection being raised there.
Well, when you read Griffin, again, taking your statement, yes, there's other evidence, it seems clear that Justice Griffin in deciding Griffin said that statement by the worker was the only evidence, period, in the whole case. And it proved the opposite of the element that he had to prove. So that is Griffin distinguishable, because we now have your statement, yes, there is other evidence in the record.
We've gotten into a terrible semantic problem. I should have probably fixed it at the beginning. There is no conflicting evidence at all on the loss of the Mount Washington. The $700,000, the object of this testimony admission, there is no evidence contradicting that. The only evidence that I have admitted to as being conflicting goes to this future question of what could have been charged but for the as income, but for the fraud or institutory breach of the defendants. This is Griffin, because there is absolutely no other evidence.
Let me ask you, and I'm not clear yet. Taking what is the total amount of money, accepting all the inferences in favor of the respondent here, that would come in the future toward this $300,000 cap? What's all those inferences?
$600,000. A little less, actually. Yeah, but $593,000.
So your argument is that none of that information goes to take away from the $700,000 loss on this other job.
Exactly.
And to get to the judgment, the respondent has to put those two figures together.
That's exactly right.
And all of his inferences and all of his testimony about the future job does not get him past the uncontroverted loss on the first job, and therefore he can't get to his $300,000, even if there was fraud by the Century Marine here that kept him from getting the $600,000.
Exactly. Even with all the disputed evidence that we're willing to concede, they're still $200,000 short of proving the real question, which is not in conflict and which is undisputed, and that is they still are $200,000 short. of the $300,000.
Well, Mr. Roach, I don't understand if that really is the record, why you need to be focusing on this judicial admission argument, because then if that really is the case and you have no uncontroverted evidence on the point that you're trying to make, then we're just in the ballpark of as a matter of law. It doesn't. We don't have to go so far as to say, here's a judicial admission, and by gosh, we're going to hang our hat on that. And because it's an admission, that's the end of the line. I mean, the judicial admission seems to me a bit of a red herring when you're talking about an as a matter of law kind of argument, and may very well be dangerous territory if, in fact, you're looking at because as I see it, your judicial admission argument has been phrased in a way that would indicate that once that statement came out of that man's mouth while he was on the witness stand, that was the end of the inquiry and no one could do anything else after that. Which is a slightly different issue than saying on this record as a matter of law this point was established.
I understand. And I think we return to where I ended, trying to return, save some time for rebuttal. We don't have to go as far as a judicial admission if it's as a matter of law. We thought it would be an important advance for the law, since Strickland was a 1960 case, to say this is the perfect situation. When the plaintiff admits himself, he can't win, he's out of court, that's something that are really
And I take
important.
It you disagree with Chief Justice Greenhill's discussion in his dissenting opinion about the difference between a formal judicial admission and an admission for purposes of the rules of evidence and how that plays out. Or do you agree with his analysis?
Well, I think I read his analysis for a different point. I was going to agree with Justice Greenhill that if it's just a witness talking about something that they perceive, that wouldn't be good enough. That's not this case. We have the person himself who was responsible for the work and responsible for the numbers, certified to the government as being accurate, admitting to a $700,000 loss.
Well, what if he admits during direct, though, $700,000 loss and then comes back on cross when his lawyer takes him then and then he starts explaining, well, here's what I really meant in terms of that, so that it really does undercut the admission.
I think
then what happens?
No, I think it stops being a judicial admission including Justice Greenhill, if he doesn't have real personal knowledge, if it's not really a key issue, if it's not something that, you know, basically they intended to say. But on this record, you couldn't come to that conclusion because his lawyer doesn't come back. All they do is prove that it's more than $700,000, and he can't quantify how much more than $700,000 it is. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Tips will present argument for
this time. May it please the court. I think I could be most helpful if I took a few minutes at the outset to explain why there is legally sufficient evidence in this record to support this verdict. I disagree with the suggestion made in the motion for rehearing that if the court considers all of the evidence, which arguably it may need to do, that Mr. Vaglica loses. I have done the math, indulging all reasonable inferences in favor of the verdict. And according to my math, Mr. Vaglica wins. And I've set out the math in this handout that I have distributed to the court this morning. And what I have done, basically, is take the mathematical calculation contained in the petitioner's brief and revise it, drawing inferences in favor of the verdict. My math differs from the petitioner's math in two fundamental ways. And the first way concerns this alleged $700,000 admission. And the second concerns a credit that was due Century Marine because Mr. Brock, who controlled Century Marine, prevented Century Marine from curing a default declared by the government, which resulted in the termination of the contract, which resulted in the government's withholding the entire retainage. And what I'd like to do is to address first those two concerns and then move to the fraud issue. As the court is well aware, The leading case with regard to judicial admissions is the Griffin case. The court has considered that issue more recently in the Hennigan versus IP Petroleum case, which I believe neither side cited, or probably should have, 858 Southwest 2nd, 371. The testimony in this case, quite frankly, does not even approach the standards established in those cases for turning a quasi-admission, to use the court's term, into a judicial admission. This testimony is not the sort of clear, deliberate, or unequivocal admission that's required by those cases. The possibility of a mere mistake has not been ruled out. As a result, this testimony is not binding. It is not conclusive. It does not preclude courts from drawing other reasonable inferences from the record. And it would not preclude this court from accepting any of the alternative arguments that are made at pages 31 through 33 of Mr. Vaglika's brief. But even if you look at Mr. Vaglika's testimony, which is what I've done in my math, you still come to the conclusion that the condition precedent could have been satisfied if reasonable inferences are drawn in his favor. And you start by looking at the testimony itself, and I have reproduced the relevant part on the second page of the handout. The petitioners rely entirely on four lines of testimony that appear on page 144 of volume 5. And that is where Mr. Vaglika, in response to a leading question, in which the questioner is trying to sum up testimony that has been given previously, says, yes, the job ended up some $700,000 in the red. But if you go back just two earlier pages, you can see that the setup to that testimony was, first of all, the questioner elicited from Mr. Vaglika testimony that the job initially was a little over $1 million in the hole, but there was then payment of a partial retainage, about $400,000. If you then take those general kind of estimate-type testimony and compare them with the precise testimony that's elsewhere in the record, you come to these conclusions. The testimony given by Mr. Vaglika, a little over $1 million in the hole, corresponds to testimony given by Mr. Abrera to the effect that the precise number was $1,027,000, and we've footnoted that reference. Even more clearly, if you take the about $400,000 of retainer, that corresponds to the precise number, which is in a document, which is $409,023. So if you do that math, what you really come up with is testimony that the actual loss at the time of termination was $617,977. What happened was the questioner, in his client's self-interest, rounded up the $700,000 and got Mr. Vaglika to agree to that, when he probably more properly should have rounded down. But the jury certainly could have concluded, looking just at Mr. Vaglika's testimony, that the starting number is not $700,000, but it's $617,977,000. You then go down the math, and there are five items which the petitioners quite properly have conceded because they must resolve inferences in Mr. Vaglika's favor. That's the next five digits that are footnoted, the reference to footnote 3. That's $597,000. The next area where I differ with the petitioners has to do with the right to cure, and that's a $232,707 number.
And to summarize at this point, one way or the other, you don't disagree so much with the $700,000. At least it doesn't make any difference whether it's $617,977 or $700,000. So the real focus is on this $232,707.
Under this alternative calculation, that's correct. This calculation results in a number bigger than $300,000, even if you replace the $617,000 with $700,000.
Right.
This is not the only formulation that's supported by the record.
But as you calculated it here, the argument then shifts to whether we're not arguing about whether $700,000 was established as a matter of law. We're arguing about whether there's any evidence to support the $232,707.
Which there is.
Okay.
But there's also, I emphasize, there's also evidence to support alternative numbers that go at the top. There's some evidence to support the Court of Appeals number. There are other arguments that are made at pages 31 through 33 of the brief. I'm presenting this one as one way the court could resolve the issue. The cure issue has to do with this. Because Mr. Brock, who controlled Century Marine, would not allow Century Marine to comply with the July 1993 cure notice, that contract was terminated, and the government was able to keep the entire $1 million retainage. And this is set out on the third page of the calculation here. You start with the amount of the retainage. That's 15% of the contract amount. And we've cited in the footnote how you back into that number. I think that's a rock-hard solid number that as of the time of the termination, the government was holding $1,041,000 that was ultimately owed to Century Marine. If Mr. Vaglika had been allowed to cure the default, According to his testimony, it would have cost between $400,000 and $500,000. So indulging reasonable inferences in his favor, he used $400,000. At the end of the day, Century Marine got $409,000 of the $1.41 million. So you have to subtract that. The point is that if Brock had not interfered with Century Marine's ability to complete the job, to cure and complete the job and avoid this penalty, Century Marine would have had another $232,000.
But only if they would have tried to cure it. Only if Baglica would have tried
if
to
he
cure
had, if he had been allowed to
if
cure.
If he had been allowed to, is there any evidence that he would have?
Yes.
What's that?
The
reply brief says on page 8 there isn't.
And there is. The reply brief makes two arguments. The first is that there is no evidence that Mr. Baglica would have complied with the cure notice. That involves a misreading of Mr. Baglica's testimony, and the key testimony is in Volume 5, pages 192 and 193. Some of the most important testimony in the whole case can be found on Volume 5, beginning about 191 through about 196. The facts are that Brock was Baglica's superior. Brock had to approve everything that Century Marine did. Baglica, and you need the testimony is a little garbled and you have to read it carefully. But if you do read it carefully and you hear it as I think the jury heard it, what is apparent is that Mr. Baglica was frustrated with his relationship with the government contractor. He disagreed with what the government contractor wanted him, or the government inspector wanted him to do. And he concluded in his business judgment that the thing to do was to force the government's hand, force them to give him a cure notice, which with which he would then be obligated to comply, but with respect of which he could then claim later that he should have not had to comply and get his money back. As he put it, his testimony was, until he forces you to do it, you don't have to. But he then goes on and says that if you're forced to by the cure notice, you have to start doing it the government's way.
But the question, I guess, was, does it make any sense to spend, $400,000 or $500,000 maybe 232 or just give up?
No, it makes sense to spend $400,000 in order to get $600,000. He ended up getting $400,000 anyway. If he had spent the money and prevented the government from terminating and withholding, he would have been $600,000 to the good. He got four of it, so he's 200 better off.
Right. But I'm saying, does it make any sense to put out four hoping that you're gonna get the two when you actually do satisfy the cure and maybe get the four back someday or just walk away from it?
Well, no, it makes sense to spend the four in order to prevent the government from terminating and withholding the entire amount of the retainage.
Because you'll make the two.
Yes. And that was what Mr. Baglica thought. That whole plan was foiled, though, when Mr. Brock, and the evidence would suggest for ulterior reasons, refused to let him spend the money. At that point, and this is the testimony that the petitioners point out to the court in their brief, at that point, Mr. Baglica, who found himself having to make the best of a bad situation, worked out a mutual plan of action, and they tried to satisfy the government anyway. But the point is that his plan was foiled by Mr. Brock, and that's why he didn't get the two. The second argument that they make is that they claim that there's no evidence that the failure to comply with the cure notice caused the government to terminate the contract. But there is, and the court need look no further than the cure notice and the subsequent termination letter, which is also attached in the packet. The jury could reason, certainly, arguably, those documents established conclusively that the termination resulted from the failure to cure. But they certainly support reasonable inferences on the part of the jury that the failure to cure resulted in the termination and accordingly resulted in their inability to get the full amount of the retainage. The petitioners point to testimony from Mr. Baglica that he considered the termination to be the result of a legal maneuver by the government. What they overlook is that the government was in a position to execute that legal maneuver and to hold on to the full amount of the retainage only because Century Marine had not cured. Now, that was the only reason that they had the right to issue a termination notice. There's also some suggestion in the briefing that Century Marine could not have completed the job on time under any event. But that, again, is belied by the testimony. The testimony is that if, or there is evidence that if Century Marine had been allowed by Brock to cure and spend the $400,000 to $500,000 that would have cost, that it could have completed the job. And the test, the evidence is on in volume five, pages first on page 192. Question: the reason that the contract was going to take that $400,000 to $500,000 to complete was not really based on the amount of work needed to be done, was it? Answer: no. And then even more clearly, volume five, page 193, beginning on line 14 down through line 23. Question: in order to get the job done during the time that you have remaining on the contract, would you have had to put people on the clock 24 hours a day? Answer: even without spending this $400,000 to $500,000, which is what it would have cost to comply with the government's cure notice, even without spending this $400,000 to $500,000, we still put two shifts on. Then at the end, to do what they expected, which is to spend the full amount of the money, we would have had to put four times that. The evidence is that had the money been spent, the job would have gotten done and it wouldn't have been terminated. Or at a minimum, there is evidence from which the jury could reasonably infer that.
Do you agree that the Court of Appeals was wrong trying to use the budget number or not?
I will concede that I can't figure out how that number works. There are better, the theory I just articulated is a far better theory than the Court of Appeals theory. There are other theories in our briefing that are better than that one. But I don't know how they take budget numbers and turn them into loss numbers. With regard to fraud, there are basically, in my formulation, the way I understand it, there are two different kinds of fraud. We in our briefing say three. I think two and three kind of merge together. And let me talk about the second one first, because the second fraud finding does not require that the court conclude that the $300,000 level would have been reached. The second fraud theory has to do is a fraudulent inducement theory. The theory begins with the proposition that Mr. Vaglica, before he ever signed the memorandum of agreement, had an oral agreement that he made at the time he sold this property to the prior owners, that if they ever went out of the business, he could buy the property back for what they paid him for it, which was $255,000. When he entered into the memorandum of agreement, he gave up any rights under that prior oral agreement. And that's plain from the last paragraph of the memorandum of agreement, which says that if you don't purchase under this agreement, our relationship will return to the way it was before the agreement, except you won't have any right to buy any assets. The evidence is that Mr. Vaglica was defrauded by Brock into entering into the memorandum of agreement and giving up his rights under the oral agreement by first the misrepresentation that the BE Key Company would require him to enter the memorandum of agreement and not honor his prior oral agreement. And that representation was made by Brock, even though he never talked to the BE Key Company about this. And second, there was the non-disclosure by Brock that, in fact, when he was encouraging Vaglica to enter into the memorandum of agreement, in fact, he and his partner, Quidel, had already concluded to try to buy the property themselves.
Mr. Roach says in his brief that because that was an oral agreement to purchase real property, that it would be barred by the statute of frauds and therefore is not enforceable, so that negates this claim. Would you respond to that argument?
Yes. We're not trying to enforce the oral agreements. We're relying primarily on this court's decision in Clements versus Withers, which recognized that an oral agreement subject to the statute of frauds could form the basis of a tortious interference claim. And the reason for that is the courts don't presuppose that parties are not going to honor oral agreements. So we're not trying to enforce the oral agreement. We simply offer the oral agreement as evidence of value. And the oral agreement gave Mr. Vaglica the right to make a very favorable purchase because he could purchase property that later was established to be worth over $500,000. I think it's $575,000 for $255,000. And that's the measure of damages that they found, 284 or something like that. And the jury could have concluded, drawn the reasonable inference, that if Mr. Vaglica had not given up that right, the right to pursue his oral agreement, that the BET company might well have honored the oral agreement, in which case he would have been $284,000 to the good. So I think the short response is that the statute of fraud doesn't apply. The other fraud theory, which does require that the court conclude that the $300,000 number has been reached, is basically a false promise theory. And the theory is that Brock proposed the memorandum of agreement to Vaglica as Vaglica's opportunity to buy the property back. Brock, though, since he controls Century Marine, knew that he could prevent Vaglica's rights under the memorandum of agreement from ever accruing. And in fact, the circumstantial evidence shows that he did do that. He did it by controlling the profits on the job, by requiring Mr. Vaglica to pay additional expenses that he shouldn't have had to pay. And his motivation, of course, is evidenced by the fact that he already had an intention to buy the property himself. That's fraud. The petitioners take the position, well, it's not fraud under the Krim Truck and Tractor versus Navistar case because Mr. Brock wasn't a party to the memorandum of agreement. Well, first of all, given Brock's relationship and ability to control Century Marine, arguably he was effectively a party to that agreement. Mr. Abrera testified at one point, I don't have the site here, that the agreement in everybody's mind was between Brock on the one hand and Vaglica on the other. But more importantly, it is fraud if a person who is in a position to influence the behavior of a party to a contract misrepresents to the other party what rights he has under the contract when he knows that he is going to be able to prevent those conditions from occurring. I can't cite the court to a white horse case for that proposition, but I think basic fraud law would lead you to the conclusion that constitutes fraud. We think that under numerous theories, the court can conclude that there is legally sufficient evidence to support this verdict and ask the court to affirm.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Let me deal first with the cure argument. The cure argument is beaten by Vaglica's admission, volume 5, pages 56, 57, that they tried this cure approach, this cure strategy. He thought it would have worked. The only reason it didn't work is because the government terminated the contract to hold on to the retainer. Government holds on to the retainer so they can get the ship into the hands of the next contractor and have somebody there in Virginia. And this is other testimony. I just stopped the testimony from Volume 5. The reason that makes sense for the government to want to terminate and hold on to the retainer is so that they can have somebody else at the place where the ship has to be moved to in Virginia do the work there. And then after that work is done, that's when they refund the $400,000 that's left on that million-dollar retainer. The point is, no matter what Mr. Vaglica or Mr. Brock would have done, the government precluded them from curing because the government terminated the contract to hold on to the retainer, Mr. Vaglica's own admission. And that's not controverted or disputed by them after he admits that. Doesn't make any difference. Justice Hankins, on your fraud, statute of frauds issue, he says we're not trying to enforce. Not exactly right. Importantly, what they're trying to do is to say I had an enforceable right. I could have sold this enforceable right to buy the property. That was valuable, and so I sustained some loss. For it to be an enforceable right, it has to satisfy the statute of frauds, and it doesn't satisfy the statute of frauds. The question of whether the $700,000, Justice Heck, your question about the cost report, the sole basis by which the Beaumont Court of Appeals gets around the testimonial admission of the $700,000 loss is not defended. If you put the $700,000 figure in, we win.
The $700,000.
And that kicked the pure argument out.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. We admit, if we lose the pure argument, we lose.
Was there anything else you can concede that might get it?
Merit. We'll concede.
I mean, we got two loses and no wins.
We got all kinds of wins.
You want to go for a third.
Merit. If we lose the merits argument, okay, and there's more money because of merit than we lose.
What's merit mean?
Merit is the claim for money because of the government's termination. But that, as you saw in the briefs, is where we say, you know, there was... They have two merit claims. One was you didn't include this claim. Well, it was included in the final thing that went to trial. And the other one was the evidence from the expert was that it was a weak claim. In his judgment, he shouldn't bring it. And there was nothing controverting that. So next point is that the merit costs, as Justice Heck, you alluded to, still have to be accounted for. In fact, Viglica admitted that the $700,000 figure was just a ballpark because there were continuing costs. The loss was going to be greater because of prosecuting Marriott. And the fact is that Marriott did go on for some time. It's not in this record because the trial occurred before the final Marriott costs were considered. The jury can't construe what the final loss will be on the Mount Washington because the costs are escalating without limit on this record. Griffin is an important case that we think ought to be reaffirmed. The argument has been made that this is not the kind of testimonial admission that ought to be approved. We think it should be for the reasons you previously stated. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument of the second cause, and we'll take another brief recess.